Welcome, everyone. Here's something I know. T. Geronimo Johnson is a rare bird. It's been my good fortune to know him in three contexts: as a writer, as a teacher, and as a pal just hanging out. He excels in all three arenas. His fiction has received wide and well-deserved acclaim. His first novel, Hold It Till It Hurts, was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. He received the Ernest J. Gaines Award for his next novel, Welcome to Braggsville, which was also named one of the year's best books by the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, NPR, the Huffington Post, Time Magazine, and many other places. And it was long listed for the National Book Award and the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. And in spite of its being an excellent work of true literature, it was also a national bestseller. You can hardly name a prominent fiction writer he hasn't been compared to. Everybody from Toni Morrison to Mark Twain, Norman Mailer to Ralph Ellison. He's taught at some pretty impressive places: Berkeley, the Iowa Writers Workshop, which is also where he got his MFA, Stanford, where he held a Stegner Fellowship, Vermont College of Fine Arts, and many other places. He's even been a curriculum designer for the San Francisco area nonprofits, which is one way that he has put his MA in language, literacy, and culture to work. I've sat through faculty meetings at other institutions with him, which is a sure way to discover if someone is full of the art or full of something else. And I can testify to his being the real deal as a major intellect as well as an artist. I've heard him be one of the few voices of reason and insight in a room full of highly educated, know-nothing, know-it-alls. His fiction has won praise for its big, genuine heart. But those who know him would say, of course he writes genuine, big-hearted fiction, because that's who he is. Genuine and big-hearted person. Whether he's pouring that out on the page or just hanging out in a kitchen somewhere swapping stories. So as a teacher myself, I have to say there's no category in which I don't give him high marks. He's also a Southern writer coming from New Orleans, which gives him yet another warm place in my heart. So please welcome our honored guest, T. Geronimo Johnson.
Hello, Braggsville. You don't know me. I'm Chinese, but I had a typical American upbringing. I was also beaten by the Vietnamese. At that, a few people chuckled. Only Charlie and Candace laughed heartily. Darren was disappointed. Lewis was Malaysian and claimed to be Chinese only when it was the easiest explanation. As he put it, it's like saying, you live in Unit 2 at Berkeley. No one knows that, so you go, San Fran, and people say, oh. I have the same relationship problems. Sometimes my girlfriend is like, why don't we go dancing? I'm thinking, this is like if I opened the fridge and the steaks were like, why don't we go hunting? They liked that one. Lewis stood a little straighter. The chair wobbled. Did he glance at Candace when he mentioned girlfriend? Darren hoped not. See, this points to the difference between the sexes. I asked her, seriously, do you think men like to dance? If we could pay admission, give a chick the same amount of cash it would take to buy 10 drinks, and take her home, we would, but that would be a brothel or a sorority house. When the crowd responded less than enthusiastically, Lewis explained, see, we have this thing in some colleges known as sorostitution. It means rich girls, never mind. So then my girl is like, But dancing is how you tell who's good in bed. Maybe so, I told her, but that's another difference between the sexes. You think we care about that? She was like, all men care about is sex. I was like, yeah, that's true, but not whether you're good at it. They liked that one. Uncle Roy pointed to Aunt Chester, who smacked his hand away. Okay, my friend Charlie is here. Let's hear it for Charlie. Charlie, Chinese people and black people have a lot in common, don't they, Charlie? Charlie clapped politely. The Wu-Tang Clan. Quint spit out his drink, laughing. Tiger Woods. The black part was cheating and the Chinese part was driving when he hit the tree. Charlie shook his head regretfully. We each give our children funny names. There was silence until he added, that white people can't pronounce. It's a conspiracy. And white people can't cook our food, but they love to eat it. Though someone here makes good-ass ribs, he hiccuped. Excuse me, good ribs. That was my black joke. I gotta represent, he gave Charlie a thumbs up. Oh yeah, Chinese people got some things in common with Southerners too. You ready for this, Braggsville? I was at this store, he pointed over his shoulder. Lose bait and cash and copy. A few people in the crowd pointed in the other direction. It's in the other direction, and it's called Lou Davis's Cash and Carry Bait Shop and Copy Center. The crowd all gestured toward town until Louis, too, was pointing in the right direction. Yeah, so Chinese people are big into directions, too. He paused, collecting himself. But I was at this store, Lou Davis's, and it was like a Chinese store. You had everything, meat, bumper stickers, everything. In Chinatown, it's like that. You can buy fruit and bread and get your teeth pulled in the back. Anyway, at Lou Davis's, I saw some strange stuff, like head cheese and all, and thought, head cheese. Maybe these people are weird. Then I had an image of my grandma eating, guess what? Chicken feet. I thought, okay, Southerners are like Chinese. We have pigs' feet and ears, and even the ovaries. A collective groan issued forth. Louis raised his hands. I don't write the news. I just deliver the paper. Whole point is, if we got the ovaries, you know we don't waste nothing. We eat everything but the oink. Or sometimes, in our case, the bark. A hush fell over the crowd. That's a joke, y'all, Louis added. And the crowd went into an uproar, clapping and stomping their feet. Louis paused, savoring the moment. He was much better than Darren expected. Louis began speaking, but in the corner, Uncle Roy whispered in Aunt Chester's ear, a mite too loudly, I think he means they eat dogs, see? And the crowd went wild again. So first, I want to thank you for that wonderful introduction and for the invitation to come here. And I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight to a reading. It's probably the least exciting thing you can do. I know some of you are probably getting credit. But I wanted to start with the stand-up because it's such a different climate now than it was when I first wrote that. And it's a piece that it's always a little bit uncomfortable to read, so I thought I would start with the discomfort. My readings, I tend to manage like dialogue, so I'm willing to take questions at any point in the reading. Want to let you know that. I'll read short sections, because I know when I go to readings and someone reads for an hour, I kind of fall asleep. Welcome to Braggsville is about four students at Berkeley who end up getting into trouble because they go to Georgia to protest a Southern Civil War reenactment that's known as Patriot Days, and Braggsville is the town that Love built in the heart of Georgia. It has four main characters. One is white from the South, one is white from Iowa, one is black from Chicago, and one is Malaysian from California. And so throughout the book, they find themselves dealing with not only the racism that they're able to point a finger at, but then learning to deconstruct what they're carrying around inside, which is partly what's happening when this stand-up routine is being told. And you'll hear this a lot when people of color are telling jokes where they do this thing where they tend to kind of eviscerate their race to try to get laughs out of people. Now I'm going to read a section that takes place back in Berkeley. Has anyone lived in the Bay Area? Anyone been out there? Okay, so you might recognize some of this. I didn't really have to make anything up. And this is at the end of his first year. He's gone back. And so at this point, he's started to understand the difference between being in Berkeley and being in San Francisco, which he'd always thought were the same thing until he moved out there. So here goes. Across the bay, the city convened in costume to race from bay to breakers. Happy Meal toys and plastic bags were long outlawed, and voters threatened circumcision and goldfish with the same fate. They'd once had a mayoral candidate named Jell-O. A roving band of rollerbladers performed the thriller zombie dance that popped nativity Friday nights in Union Square. And heck, it was the UN in the airport. Yet the city thought Berserkly was weird. Duran thought it beautiful. Never mind the Nag Champa. Never mind the crusty hippies and gutter punks in greasy jackets, stiff as shells, lined up on Telegraph Ave, hawking tie-dye and patchouli and palming for change. On clear days, a pageantry of wind and water under sun, the bay a sea of gently wriggling silver ribbons, and the Golden Gate hovering in the distance like a mystical portal. East of campus lazed tawny hills. On foggy days, blinding bales of cotton candy strolled the avenue's dandy, while in the distance the tips of the bridge towers peeked through the mist like shy, gossamered nipples. The Bay Area was a beautiful woman who looked good in everything she wore. What had intimidated him those early weeks of his freshman fall semester felt like home during his second semester, freshman spring. The clock tower known as the Campanile rose from the center of campus with the confidence of the Washington Monument, marking time in style. And on the hour, music students sounded melodies on the carillon. He often lunched alone at the base of that monolith on the cool stone steps, facing the water due west, attention drifting with the lazing waves and the steady stream of Asian students migrating between the library and the engineering buildings. As he worked up the courage to wander farther from Sather Gate, the symbolic campus border, he discovered Indian, Vietnamese, Mexican, Thai, tastes luring him deeper and deeper into a town of Priuses and peddlers, both of which yielded patiently to pedestrians. Laid back, liberal, loose, the locals' mantra, no worries. The transplant's motto, it looks like a peninsula, but feels like an island. So one of the things that the students do before they disrupt the Civil War reenactment is they do kind of a trial run at Six Flags, and they decide they have to practice their performative intervention. And Six Flags in Vallejo is on land that was formerly native land, kind of like the rest of America, right? And so what they are interested in particular is the story of Ishii. The thing about Ishii that's so sad is that he's put into police custody for his own protection. He was given a free apartment in the Museum of Anthropology. Isn't that great? You know, he could sit and like make baskets and stuff, and people could walk by and look at him and, you know, learn about how the natives lived. So they're not too happy when they discover this. And So what happens is Candace decides that they should go to Ishii, and this is the section where she's convincing her friends that they need to go to Ishii, to Six Flags, to kind of restore Ishii's legacy. And so this section has three languages, trigger warning, three languages. A little bit of Spanish, a little bit of Malaysian, which is just a Malaysian translation of the Spanish, and then a little bit of English. But here's the problem. I'm a writer, not a mathematician. Actually, it has four languages, because of course it has English, then the Spanish, and the Malaysian, and then it also has this thing called different strokes language. So, why are they going to do this? ¿Por qué? ¿Por qué no? ¿Por qué? As she explained it, Ishii is Yahi for man. Ishii is Yahi for Ishii. ¿Por qué? As she explained it, there was a difference between apologizing and anthropologizing, and neither excuse the desecration of a body. For Kay, as she explained it, they were Ishii's remains. They are Ishii's remains. If a picture was a captured soul, what the hell was a book of them? What was the history of one people written by another, except an imaginary menagerie, a colonial shadow box? A little foot warmer for those cold existential evenings, an amulet against those starless, soulless nights. You understood none of it except the part about the foot warmer, which you knew was a myth of northern aggression, though you daren't interrupt when the spirit combed her tongue. Mengapa, Mengapa Tadak? Is that Malay? You know I don't actually speak Malay, except for curse words, right? Mengapa, Mengapa Tadak, Karana, as she explained it, if everything's symbolic, then everything's real. Then when we spread these ashes in Vallejo, people will know. They will know that UC Berkeley, supposedly the best public university in the world, took a man and made him live in a museum like an Epcot Center attraction. People will ask questions. People will demand answers. They will find that there are none, and that will be the beginning of a reckoning. What you talking about, Willis? What I'm talking about, Willis, she explained, is how could any decent human force the last living member of a tribe to live in a museum? Ishii, how Ishii must have dreamed at night, how Ishii must have dreamed, how Ishii must dream even now. Though the museum and Kroeber both promised that Ishii's body would not be desecrated, Ishii was autopsied in defiance of native custom, Ishii's body cremated, and Ishii's brain wrapped in deerskin and shipped by mechanical conveyance to the Smithsonian. Ishii, how Ishii must dream. The feeling at the time is that they felt what was best for everyone involved, and the Kroeber's descendants have written a lot about this, the anthropologist who led the initiative, and so the family is still wrestling with this legacy. One of Kroeber's children, by the way, though, is Ursula Le Guin, and there are books where she has tried to take restorative stance. And an interesting thing about Le Guin is that when she has written novels, things have changed now, but in the past when she has written novels where she had characters of color, the publisher would still insist on rendering them as European on the cover of the book. Okay, so I'm thinking that maybe I'll read something sad. He liked to think of himself as an honest guy, but he was starting to think that he'd never really told the truth when it mattered. When Lamont Jackson caught shrapnel that sheared off the back of his helmet and head clean-like, easy as scooping ice cream, and his brains looked like, well, a pickled walnut, he asked Achilles if he was going to make it. And Achilles was so transfixed by the sight of the open skull, so certain he was cursed to see this side of a friend, he couldn't answer. He tried nodding. Everyone was talking and yelling and screaming, but they couldn't hear shit, and neither could Achilles. Jackson was mouthing the words. All Achilles had to do was mouth the words, yes, you'll make it. He couldn't. He half nodded, but Jackson had that look in his eye like he knew Achilles was lying. And, worse yet, he forgave him for it. That was the real burn, that a dying man held forth grace for Achilles the living, who hadn't the courage to be forthright and tell him, yes, say your prayers or meditate or think of your mom or conjure the memory you want to take home with you, because you sure don't want it to be Sergeant Achilles Holden Conroy, fly-eyed and crying and sweating on you about to shit his own pants. You sure don't want it to be the crumpled remains of the bombed nursery we crossed yesterday, each brick a tiny headstone. You sure don't want it to be the sound of men crying and running scattershot in the dark, screaming for their mamas, and not like babies, but like only men can scream. And you sure don't want it to be the decapitated Muslims killed by other Muslims and left on the side of the road because the townspeople who moved to bury the dead are judged co-conspirators and dispatched to join them, because to attend to them is to sympathize, to confer dignity is to abet, because compassion is outlawed. And you don't want it to be Lionel Dinkins who took the brunt of the blast, acrid, pungent, something you should never smell. And you don't want it to be the way the sand under your back is hot, so hot it's like it's baking you through the flak jacket, or the corn that suddenly aches like a scorpion stung your toe because of how your boots pinch at the end of the day because your feet have swollen to what seems like twice their normal size. And it can't be the swishing of your pants as your legs twitch, because that's too much like running, which you'll never do again. And you don't want it to be the sound of your feet flopping in the sand. It's too much like the sound of sifting, and you'll wonder what's being left behind. And you don't want it to be the sound of your own tears, with your heart beating too loudly in your ears and your sobs echoing in your chest, because you never rest well when you cry yourself to sleep. But he didn't say any of that. He stared blindly and swallowed often, even though his mouth was so dry, each contraction was like forcing a sharp chunk of burning granite down his throat. But he had to say something, so he said to Lamont, "Remember how you told me that your mom used to put jelly between your pancakes and still let you put syrup on top?" And he held Lamont Jackson's hand, and the tighter Jackson squeezed, the tighter Achilles squeezed. And he said, "You know how you told me that your lady's dog used to get upset when you spent the night and would piss in the hallway, and you won't be mad about it when you go home?" Jackson grinned widely. "Jealous devil, my Jody's a dog." The grin faded, and he said, "Don't leave me." He tried to speak again, but no more came out, and an Afghan kid in the background was laughing, and Jackson squeezed Achilles' hand tighter, and Achilles squeezed back and felt the sun biting his neck, the sand in his mouth, in his socks, his ears. It was like there was sand every fucking where, even in his goggles. There was even sand in his ass, and it was so fucking hot, he was gonna shit glass. And the knee pad straps pinching his knees, and the helmet strap slicing his Adam's apple, and his belt buckle cutting into his waist, and his pistol butt digging into his ribs, and it felt like everything that was supposed to be protecting him was choking him to death. And he said to Jackson, "Know how you say when we get back to the barracks and drop this shit off, it feels like we can fly?" And Jackson nodded and went still, but his grip was so tight, Achilles was a long time freeing himself. And after the perimeter was secure, when they reassembled in the silence of the aftershock, Wages calmly directing with his hands, the laughing Afghan kid defiant to the end, smiling even as he dropped to the ground, clutching his neck, knees to the dirt in a soft puff of dust, Merryweather with blood on his fingers and a glazed look in his eyes, putting the blade away wet as casually as zipping up, Wexler leaning against the burned-out Hulk, sobbing, spitting on Merryweather. Achilles looked at his brother Troy, who had switched seats with Jackson, and was just so glad that they were alive, and the sun was dead behind Troy's head like a halo, so Achilles couldn't see his face. And he was so happy Jackson had switched seats with Troy, and that whole fucking thing drove him fucking crazy. The whole idea, the idea that somehow by Troy being there is impossible for Achilles to really give a fuck about anyone else in the squad, because it was like there was a tax and someone always had to pay it. And as long as it wasn't Achilles or Troy, it was okay. And he knew he shouldn't feel that way. He knew he should want them all to make it out, but he knew they couldn't. He knew somehow in a way he couldn't explain, because he'd never believed in ESP or clairvoyance, but he knew that of the eight that started, only four would survive. And no matter what happened at each formation or prayer group, he could never muster the words, "Let's do it," or "We got this," or "We put the fun in funeral." He could only say, "That's right." And that was the look he must have worn as a mask while Jackson died, a tense smile that said, "It's as bad as it looks, and it probably feels worse, but at least it's you and not us." I'm very rigid in my sense of craft when I was in school, and then kind of apostate afterwards. And so what was happening by the time I was working on Braggsville is that I was trying to get a 360 degree view as much as possible on this really uncomfortable issue of race, not from a point of view of like what's easy, someone said a bad word or someone won't give you a job, but the space, right, that interests me as a writer. And this is how I'm coming to point of view. I'm coming to my craft decision with certain purpose in mind. And so what interests me as a writer is not what people say that they shouldn't. It's very easy to point your finger at that. It's not what people even share in mixed company. Who knows what they say at a Klan rally? It's probably not that interesting. But it's more so what people don't know they are thinking, right? Like the ideas that we have inherited about other humans that we haven't necessarily filtered, right? The things that impress upon us that we haven't been able to defend against. And so what the point of view is trying to do is move into this slippery space between what the characters know to say and what they're thinking but can't admit even to themselves. So the point of view is positioned to move between spoken language and free and indirect discourse. And that's also why there's no or very seldom any quotation marks in this particular novel. So this is what the point of view in this case is kind of, and usually I would think of it as, you know, there are various factors working maybe like a telescope. This is someone's positionality, their subjectivity, and then this is what they're observing. But in this case, it's kind of a device that's more endoscopic, so it goes both out and in. You learn craft only so that you can subvert it to your particular purposes. And when I was writing this novel, it's been really hard for me to sell books at first, because for a while everyone was like, you're an okay writer, but this whole race thing, like, why do you keep writing about race? Race is over in America. Can you, like, write about, like, sports? Isn't that weird? And like, why do you write about race? You could write about sports, you know? I would say, yeah, sure. And what I was trying to do is, like, find a way to write about race that got at some of the things that we weren't discussing. And so that's why point of view was so important. Yeah, and syntax, yes. I think that growing up, and this is embedded in the history of literacy and education, you know, the English essay is the model for the essay, and the English accent is, in a way, considered like the exemplar of articulation within the language. When I was growing up, I would say that if anything was posed upon me as the idea of just basic standard English as being this kind of gold standard. But as I went into the world, I found that anytime I heard people speaking something other than standard English, that's what would interest me. Like hearing people speak in ways that express their uniqueness or what's unique about their culture. After I wrote Hold It and I felt more free, what I wanted to do was try to pull in different voices, because I felt that I needed to not only honor different voices, but use these different voices to get to the complexity of the texture of human relationships in America and in the world. And then personally, like we were talking a little bit about accents, like I couldn't do them. We were talking about them at dinner, like how does an actor learn to do accents? So like I said, I never learned how to do accents, but there's something I find pleasing to the ear. So for me, a lot of it is also just this kind of sonic appreciation. And then of course, I'd said living in the North and then living in the South, people speak very, very differently. And it was all of that. And then, you know, and then of course the whole like talking white thing I'd mentioned to you. So basically when I moved to New Orleans from Maryland, I was in the Spanish class. Isn't it funny? I was in a Spanish class when I was accused of talking white. Then years later, when I was writing behind the book essay for Braggsville, I realized that the student in the Spanish class who accused me of talking white was actually the only white student in the class. There's no punchline. Like, that's just, this is just like, life is weird, right? Life is weird. And so I think that's something else that I might be trying to get at by using the different voices, but I like the sound. It's, of course, it's impossible not to read someone saying that you're like Toni Morrison or Mark Twain and to feel a pitter-patter in your little writer heart, but I don't feel like I do well what either of them do so well, and so I'm comfortable with both comparisons. They're masters of their own language, you know, and then I'd probably say neither. That it kind of surprised me in both cases, but at the same time, I think that the only thing we might have in common would be more of our social positioning and the fact that we're writing about things sometimes that people don't really want to talk about. I feel like that might be what we have in common. But aesthetically, if I could write like Toni Morrison, I don't even know what I would do. All right, so I was going to read something that's completely brand new, never been read before in public. I'm working on a neo-neo-slave narrative. I would call it a neo-neo-neo-slave narrative, but then you might interrogate me. That's what happened at dinner about the meaning of all three neos. So basically, it's just like an update on the latest update of the slave narrative. Has anyone read a slave narrative recently? There's something about the introduction, like the rhetorical work of the introduction, that is so fundamentally disturbing to me. There's something just so disturbing about this vouching for character. So I want to read this introduction to my neo-neo-slave narrative. Oh, dearest fellow reader, if before venturing beyond the aforementioned spiritual charnel house, if you should require, as would any commonsensical member of our great Christian race possessed of that most glorious rectitude, affirmation and attestation regarding the character of the narrator and confirmation of the narrator's good standing, let it be known that the humble author is in every moral aspect reformed and desirous only of bettering the self, that the family may be provided for more fully and the race by example inspired. And though the raconteurish mind may appear at times impaired by angst, deliriously fevered by retribution and animus, muculent and bestial obsession and gaze, those fantasies are but the most superficial and ephemeral divertissement of a faculty riddled soft by the perennial sowing of an implacable penitence implanted by many who shame our great Christian race in their incessant kindling of discomposure and dubitation in the innocent souls of those within our charge. I therefore implore you, you fellow immaculate soul, bypassed with haste the aquatic interlude of the first chapter, that impermeable shroud of baseless puzzling and perplexing lamentation, and alight thine unimpeachable eye and discerning eye upon chapter 2, where you will find a main narrative greatly more porous and supple, greatly more prone and sober, prostrate even. I also implore you, my dear fellow sage, nay, you fellow guiltless spirit, you fellow custodian of civilization, you my brethren, the quintessence of magnanimity, I pray you, good sir, read with generosity of spirit and grace, and bear no malice toward our humble author for the unavoidable errors. Yea, stand ye in transposition, that you may recognize the erratic dramatic errata as noble and baroque testaments to veracity. Truthfully, if I may be so bold as to speak under aegis of our Redeemer, I pray you of monastic chastity and comprehensive probing intellect, you my fellow ecumenical evangelical, you my brother in redemption, I pray invite you, quit our humble narrator of those syntactical and grammatical charges silently presented and deliberated within the rational mind, for though unvoiced, that internal enterprise, yet august, yet the central distinction of our Hellenistic heritage, yet essential to our safe passage round turpitude, as does the lighthouse by constancy of resolve and illumination steer the ship round the wicked cape, that internal enterprise cannot but distract a Christian soul from its most solemn and noble ambition, which is to serve as our good teacher's proxy through emulation in grace, forgiveness, compassion, and charity. Read upright in heart this account of calamity and deliverance. Read with compassion for the vicissitudes of the nascent mind, unyet endowed with the sapience our good Creator saw fit to bestow upon our Christian being, that our spirits may delight in the sacred translucence through which His divinity is known. Read with pity and ruth. That's just sort of what they sound like to me.
I didn't want to do that, to kind of point the finger anywhere in particular. So Berkeley is a real place just because, well, Berkeley's actually not really a real place, but, you know, there was this habit in the past of setting the capital in the geographical center of the state so it would be an equal distance for everyone. And so Braggsville is in this mythical spot, the capital that never was, in the center of Georgia, and it's known as the town that Love built. And it's just named after a man named Bragg whose caravan broke down there. Well, thank you for coming out.